Hey, and welcome to the Nikonian's Image Doctor podcast. This episode is number 48 for August 30th, 2007. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we once again have a full show for you, full of Nikon goodies.
As well as other things.
Yep, all things photography.
Yeah, but certainly the Nikon goodies are going to take the headline this week, I think.
That's for sure.
It's been an interesting week.
It's been a fun week to be a Nikonian.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the new announcements from Nikon that came out just last week.
Right. Both and the cameras and the lenses.
That's right. And we've got some listener mail, and then we're going to talk a little bit about some possibly overlooked software accessories.
Yeah. Smaller programs that may be useful for specific things that you're doing.
But first, let's go into our listener mailbag and answer an email that we got from our listener, David Hayes. And David had some questions about our filter episode from a few weeks ago, and he wanted us to clarify the difference between hard and soft ND grad filters. What does that mean?
Right. And the difference between two, in both cases, you've got a portion of the filter that's dark and a portion that's clear. And the difference is how that transition occurs. With a hard-edged filter, if you look at it, you'll actually see a pretty hard edge between the dark area and the clear area.
Like someone took a ruler and drew a line across it.
Just about. It's not quite that hard, but that gives you a good idea of what it's like. And with a soft-edge one, it's just a more gradual transition. It just gradually bleeds into the clear area, the dark area it does. So that's the difference between the two. Now, how do you use those? Well, what I find is that if I've got a really well-defined horizon or some other horizontal line, which happens to be about where I want to place the grad, then I use the hard-edged one. And that works well because I get an immediate change to the dark area. It's not quite as immediate as it looks on the filter. It always softens up a little bit when you actually use it in a photograph. But it's still a fairly quick change. Now, when I have something that isn't close to a straight line, or approximately a straight line, then I'll use the soft edge one, and that works great with situations where you might have some hills or trees or whatever, and you don't want the edge to show up a lot.
I've also heard that hard edge filters are easier to use with your slightly longer focal length lenses, where you might choose a soft edge with the wide angle lens.
Yeah.
As far as which one's better, I only have one set. I have the soft. That's the way I went because I figured they'd be more versatile if I could only have one.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really matter.
No,
as long as you know what you're doing.
Yeah, I've got both hard and soft. I actually use the hard a little bit more than the soft, but they're both useful to have.
Now, David had another question for us, and he wanted to know about upcoming photo safaris with the Image Doctors and whether or not we're planning any trips and how strenuous the activity is, i.e. if we went back to Texas to do that trip. And the answer is, well, we don't have any official trips scheduled as of yet. We are looking forward to doing some more workshops in 2008,
right.
And we definitely will tailor them to make it so that they're not strenuous, so that no one has to, we don't hike up the side of mountains when we do our excursions. And by way of comparison, the Texas shoot, we drove to the blinds and maybe had to walk 50 feet, 100 feet at most.
Right. I think we will require some sort of a medical form signed by a doctor relating to beer consumption, but that's even optional.
Yeah, that's right. That's not mandatory on our trips, but it certainly is a pleasure.
Yeah. So at any rate, that was our little bit of shameless self-promotion.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, we do look forward to trying to offer some workshops in 2008.
Yeah, we have a couple good ideas going.
Okay, well then the big news, of course, this week has been all a buzz in all the forums, Nikonians and otherwise, regarding the latest announcements of two new cameras by Nikon, the new flagship D3, and which is Nikon's first entry into the full frame, or what I like to call 35 millimeter format frame, and Nikon calls it FX format, which is, I think, a good marketing angle. And then the D300, which is really interesting because I don't think any of us really saw that one coming.
Now, both of us had a pretty decent idea of what they were going to release, but we were still surprised.
Yeah.
I remember getting up that morning and just looking on my computer to see what had come out, and I was like, holy mackerel.
And
wow.
Yeah. And so my head is still being scratched by myself. I'm still scratching my head as to which one of these I find more compelling, because they're both really good for different reasons. And I think, philosophically speaking, Nikon is doing some really interesting things with the way they're going after the pro and high-end amateur market with, mm-hmm. or just the pro market even, with yeah. both of these bodies.
Now, let's just talk briefly about them and their features, just top level. And obviously, we have not used these.
Right. Neither of us has seen them. Neither of us have been to Tokyo, although pre-production models exist. And some D3 images are floating around out there from the Osaka Track and Field World Championships. Hard to say whether or not those are valid indications of the image quality. So this is all going to be based
complete
on what
conjecture.
We've read. Yeah, yeah, completely conjecture from what we've read spec-wise. And so you want to start with the D3 or the D300, Rick?
Let's start with the D3.
The big monster.
Right.
I think what surprised a lot of people is that the D3 is a 12-megapixel FX frame or full-frame format mm-hmm. SLR that shoots 9 frames a second. I think the megapixel war has been fought over the last few years. Everyone sort of expects more and more pixels on their sensor.
Yeah.
But this 12-megapixel D3 is it's going to have a 36x24-inch sensor. So it's 35 millimeter format.
36x24-inch?
Or millimeter. I got to go back to metric. Am I in the English system again? Let me revert
yeah,
back to
switch.
Metric. 36x24 millimeters, folks, as yeah. I'll hit myself in the head. And one of the interesting things is that the D3 brings out an entirely new autofocus module.
Yeah.
Which I really was kind of surprised to see
yeah.
so quickly. Put it in perspective, the cam... What was it? The Cam 19. What was the one in the F5? I can't remember. The Cam 1900 or whatever it was called, or 1500. Yeah, my brain is a little bit slow this evening.
The F5s.
The F5's autofocus module was in production for a really long time before we saw the Cam 2000 come out. And it was Cam 1300 is what it was,
okay.
I think. Before the Cam 2000 replaced it in the D2 series and in the F6. Mm-hmm. So in really only 3 years later, we see a new Cam called Cam 3500. And this thing has 51 user selectable AF points.
You'd think that would be enough.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because other manufacturers have a lot of AF points, but they're not individually selectable. Like, I know in the Canon system, there's selectable points and then what's called assist points, mm-hmm. which you can't choose manually, but they're there to help the autofocus acquire and track a target.
Right. Now, I believe with these, you can simplify things, too, by choosing to group them.
Correct. And speaking of grouping, the D3 and also the D300, as you'll see in a second, they have gotten rid of the single area dynamic AF mode, or they've sort of gotten rid of the group dynamic and it's now a hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
It's more akin to what was group dynamic autofocus.
Which, if you listen to some of our old podcasts, that's what we recommended as being the more useful
mm-hmm.
setting.
So there's only three autofocus settings, single area, a sort of group dynamic like setting that they call dynamic, and then the, completely dynamic autofocus setting, which is just let the camera pick out
yeah.
the subject for you,
yeah.
as far as we can tell. But another interesting thing is then the autofocus sensor in these new cameras apparently uses information from the image sensor, from the metering sensor, to help track objects. So there's that 1,005 pixel RGB meter,
mm-hmm.
and supposedly this autofocus sensor is going to be picking up color data. So, like, if you're tracking the guy in the red shirt, in theory, it knows that that's your subject and can follow the guy in the red shirt.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
If that's true, I'm all for it. You know, it's
yeah.
more interesting to see how that pans out. Nikon was quick to point out their new image processing chip called X-Speed.
Ooh.
And so they gave it a name. But the bottom line is that the D3 is able to deliver 9 frames a second in 14-bit RAW,
mm-hmm.
which is a new upgrade from the previous DSLRs, which were 12-bit.
Yeah, so it's two better.
It's two better.
Yeah.
It's debated. We can have another discussion as to whether or not how important those extra bits are.
But we won't.
Yeah, we won't. Not today. And then the D3 has a crop mode.
Uh-huh.
And it has a couple of crop modes. And I think this is some of the reasons that make this camera intriguing. First thing it'll do is it'll detect a DX lens automatically.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put a DX lens on the D3, it will automatically crop out and mask the viewfinder out, black out the area, and just use the 1.5x crop. But the other crop mode is the one I think is even more interesting, and that's a 5:4 aspect ratio crop.
Great for portrait photographers.
Right. I mean, I saw that spec and I immediately thought that wedding photographers everywhere are really going to, and portrait photographers mm-hmm. are really going to like that idea because it saves you work in post-processing. If you print a lot of 8x10 or 16x20, 11x14, they all use the 5:4 aspect ratio. And if you've ever composed using a normal camera's aspect ratio, that means you got to do some cropping and you can't always get the composition right. So I think this crop mode will be useful for those shooters who shoot a lot of weddings and portraits. Yeah.
Of course, one of the really interesting things about the D3 is its ISO range.
Yeah, that's Holy just amazing.
25,000 something?
Yeah, it goes in spec. The D3 has a range from 200 to 6400 ISO, mm-hmm. and then you can boost that up by two full stops to get 25,600.
Or take it down to 100.
And you can also, right, take it down to 100. And a lot of people are sort of out there on the forums asking about why no ISO 100? And why is it ISO 200 as the base? Well, Nikon uses the standard set for image sensitivity for DSLRs that says the base ISO should be the value that gives you the cleanest possible image, the absolute best image quality. Therefore, ISO 200 is that setting for these new cameras. You can get to a 100 sort of artificially by playing with the gain a little bit, but the best quality will be had at 200, so that's what they made, the base ISO. But it's amazing to think that we can go to 6400 in spec. And by in spec, I mean, we're not talking high one, high two. That's another thing that Nikon does, is that they're pretty conservative with their ISO ratings. And they won't call something an ISO value unless they feel the images will be usable from it. I mean, good quality. That's not to say you can't get usable images from the higher settings, but they tend to be conservative. So if they're saying it goes to 6400, that means that we should be able to get fairly decent images out of that setting.
Yeah.
I mean, what it really means is that 3200 should be great.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
And part of the reason for that is Nikon chose to go with that 12 megapixel sensor. What other features in the D3? It's got the form factor is that it has the built-in vertical grip.
Right.
It'll have a wireless transmitter option. It uses the same batteries as the current D2 system.
Which is nice.
Very nice. If you have a D2 as a backup camera, you mm-hmm. can use the same batteries.
Yeah, most of the other things are pretty much as expected. You know, 100% accuracy on the viewfinder. Oh!
The new LCD panel.
Yeah.
That Ooh. Thing is supposed to be just hot.
Yeah. Now, it's a little bit bigger, and that's not a surprise.
3 inches.
Most people expected it to go up to 3 inches. But the resolution is quite high. And then it's also got the live view mode.
Right.
Which operates in a couple different ways, actually.
Yeah, and that'll be something to discuss when we've actually seen one of these cameras.
Yeah.
But the idea is that this sensor gives you the equivalent of a 640 by 480 VGA picture, which from everything that I've heard so far says that it's astounding. It's like looking at it on a real computer screen. It's almost mm-hmm. like looking at a print. So it really ups the ante in terms of quality for reviewing your images. So if you're into chimping, this will be really fun.
Yeah. So those are some of the highlights on the D3. How about the D300?
Well, this
one. Were you surprised by this one?
I was absolutely surprised by this one for a couple of reasons. First of all, the D200, while you could argue that it was in need of a refresh, possibly a D200S, I certainly wasn't expecting a complete
Well, you know what's funny about this is we were talking about this subject maybe a month or two ago, because we had, certainly heard rumors mm-hmm. about a new model there, and we were discussing, well, what would you do with a D200 to enhance it? And, you know, we thought, well,
maybe a better sensor.
Yeah, you know, we were thinking maybe a little bit better, higher ISO performance, perhaps. Again, not that it's bad. And we thought, well, I guess you could make the display on the back a little bit bigger, you know, make it a 3-inch perhaps. But then we started running out of ideas.
Yeah, it really is. There's not too much you can do to a D200, in our opinion, to really, the way we
it's
were
a good
thinking.
Camera.
Now, we were thinking inside the box, and apparently
right.
Nikon wasn't. Yeah. Because what Nikon has done with this camera is that they've given us all of the goodness of the D200 body, the small form factor, the professional build quality, the weather sealing. But they have chosen not to cripple it in any way.
No.
Compared to what the D200 was going up against, which was the flagship D2X.
Yeah, and this is actually doing, you know, one better
yeah.
than the D2X in many respects.
So the D300 is a DX format camera, so it's mm-hmm. it's still our same 1.5 crop that we're used to with Nikon.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't changed. It uses a brand new sensor, a 12.4 effective or 12.3 effective megapixel sensor. So it's actually a couple more pixels bigger than what you get out of a D2X sensor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brand new sensor, and it's rated from ISO 200 to 3200 in spec
and
with a
D2X,
one-stop push.
And the D2X was 100 to 800.
Right.
So, you know, could make you could draw the conclusion that it's perhaps two stops better at the high end. We'll see when the images come out and the test results.
And when you think about it, what most people have been asking for is better performance at the high end rather mm-hmm. than, you know, anybody can shoot ISO 100 mm-hmm. was kind of the attitude.
Yeah.
Now, we expect really clean images at the low ISOs from Nikons.
Yeah.
They've always delivered that way.
Right.
But a new sensor.
So some of that was a surprise, and not the high ISO improvements maybe, if that happens.
But the autofocus module is the same identical module as the D3. Now, this is unheard of for Nikon, and we'll talk about it later when we finish talking about the cameras. We'll give our thoughts on where we think Nikon's going, but I think this is signifies something important in terms of how Nikon is diversifying their product line.
Right.
But no longer do you have to say, gee, do I get a D2 and pay twice as much for this better autofocus, because now you've got the flagship D3 and the D300 using the same autofocus module, the CAM 3500, with 51 autofocus points and all the same modes. That's incredible. The same image processing chip,
mm-hmm.
and our image processor can give us 6 frames a second in full DX frame,
mm-hmm.
and then there's an optional battery grip just like the D200, but as you'll see, it gives you 8 frames a second in full DX mode without having to crop the image down.
Yeah, it also appears to be made a little bit better.
Yeah, a metal body mm-hmm. Grip and a little bit lower profile. The grip is built so that it doesn't have the piece that extends into the battery chamber.
Right.
So it's just the bottom part, and it looks very well made. And one of the things I like about that grip is it's got the additional thumb pad for controlling autofocus sensors.
Right,
and that's something that we've only seen before on the F6, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very, very cool.
Yeah. Now the D300 does have a 14-bit mode.
Correct.
But from what we can tell, if you switch into that, you're going to limit the number of frames per second.
There's some conflicting information out there, and I've talked to some people, I've read some places. I can't find it officially on any of Nikon's published specs, but there's a rumor saying that if you shoot 14-bit NEFs, it'll lower the frame rate substantially. Now, I haven't seen it proven yet, so we'll wait to see.
Yeah.
Now, in my opinion, is that a little bit of a downer? Sure, but if you're shooting 8 frames a second, you're usually not trying to extract the maximum bit depth.
Mm-hmm.
You're usually trying to get the shot.
Right.
And certainly, having shot 12-bit NEF on our current bodies, I don't think either of us are complaining about the image quality.
Yeah.
Those 2 bits may or may not be that important. For applications where you want the kind of range, a slower frame rate probably isn't going to hurt you. Things like portraits, things like landscapes, where mm-hmm. you're not shooting 8 frames a second.
Mm-hmm.
So that remains to be seen.
Right. Now, you know, some other little tidbits in there that were a surprise to me. The viewfinder was improved.
100% coverage.
Right. It was 95% before. That's a great thing, especially on a digital camera. You know, with film cameras, you had that argument of, well, the photo processor is always going to, you know, take a little bit off when making the print, right, or the slide mount will cover a little bit. But that's not the case with digital. So
right,
that's a nice, useful thing, and I was surprised by that. And then it gets the same great monitor on the back.
Yeah, the same LCD D3 monitor. And like the D200, it has the built-in pop-up speed light. You either find that to be a feature or not. But I think the really interesting thing here is that the D300 on paper, in my opinion, is going to replace the D2X mm-hmm. in terms of what it can do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not to say that the D2X isn't a great camera, but I think the D300 is positioned to replace the D2X on spec because it's got faster frame rate without having to do all the crop stuff, better, presumably better sensor, better high ISO performance, very good build quality, vertical grip option. So your form factor gives you some options when you want to pack light versus mm-hmm. you want to boost speed. The vertical grip, incidentally, will accept a D2 battery, the ENEL4.
Right.
And one other feature that the D300 has that I thought was interesting is the sensor cleaning mode. It vibrates the sensor.
Right.
To try, and so apparently it does this with four different resonant frequencies to try to maximize the performance of getting dust off. I don't really see this as a, you know, it's there. You can decide whether or not that's important to you. The jury for me is still out on whether those sensor cleaning, shaking sensor technologies were, and it moves by shaking the anti-aliasing filter. It doesn't right. actually move the sensor itself. And it has the same live view modes as the D3.
Right.
Which right. could be useful in certain circumstances when mm-hmm. you're trying to, to compose a shot without looking through the viewfinder.
Yeah.
Then we got the new lenses.
Right.
And
let's talk about the wide angle zooms first.
Right. Well, we got a 14-24 f/2.8 full frame, 35 millimeter frame coverage lens.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's as wide as wide gets.
Right. Now, one thing that's, people have been talking a little bit about is the fact that it doesn't have any filter threads.
True.
On the front of the lens. And that's because it's got a very bulbous front element that sticks out quite a bit. And that is a little bit of a limitation. I've got a 14 millimeter lens and it's got the same shape and the same issue. And
lens flare could be an issue with that front element like that.
Potentially. I've used grads with that lens. You certainly don't want to try to hold them in front of the lens like you might with others. There's just such tremendous depth of field that unless you get the thing just perfectly placed, which is hard to do if you're just holding it with your hand, then you can see the edges of the filters. You'll get tilted slightly, and then you can get flare. That doesn't work well. What I think might work well if you wanted to use grads with the lens is get a little bit of what's either called blue tack or fun tack. Depends on where you live as to what it's called. And you just put two little tiny globs.
Oh, the stuff you use to stick posters up on your walls?
Yeah, and then you can put a grad on just temporarily with that. It won't leave any residue on the grad to speak of, and you can actually get some pretty nice flexibility on placement with them. And then you just put that blue tack or whatever mm-hmm. on the two little spots in the hood. And actually, a lot of photographers use that anyway. On lenses, I tend to like the holders, but it is potentially an option.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that it gives you a range that's actually usable on a DX body, too.
Right.
Because a 14-24 is going to still be a very wide-angle lens,
mm-hmm.
And it's an f/2.8. Compare that to the similarly priced but slightly cheaper 12-24 DX lens, which is an f/4. So you could use it on there's no reason that you couldn't use these full-frame lenses on DX crop bodies. So that's... There's no worry there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got a 24-70 f/2.8, which is going to replace the 28-70 in Nikon's lineup. Mm-hmm. And these are all AFS focusing lenses
mm-hmm.
to the internal wave motor. And that's a nice range. And I think it's going to be very useful for a lot of people who buy a D3.
Yeah. The 28-70 was a great lens. Very sharp, very low distortion and all those things. So this is a little bit wider. It's a little bit trimmer.
A newer, slightly newer design, so it right. should be equally good, if not better.
Yeah.
I think it's a little narrower build, right, so right. it might be a little easier to handle.
Yeah. It probably would have been nice if it had VR. People have noted that.
I agree.
That would have been a little bit more compelling for people that currently have a 28-70 to go out there and switch.
you can go to ISO 6400 on a D3, and then you don't.
I know that's the crazy thing about some of this stuff. Is
that kind of, but yeah, you'd like to be able to shoot at a lower ISO. I mean, yeah. VR would be good, but it's going to be a pro Nikon lens. I expect nothing less than this to be an excellent performer because their track record in that focal length range has been just awesome.
Yeah.
And then finally, what we've all been waiting for is that the big guns finally got their VR.
Thank God.
Yeah, it's been a long time. These are now, so the 400-28, the 500 and 600 F4 are now G designs, but they have VR in them. Mm-hmm. And they have the tripod mode VR, so you can use them on a tripod with the stabilizer on. And I think what's even better is, there's some pluses and minuses compared to the previous version. They're heavier than the previous version. The previous version of the, which was the AFS-2 range, was a little bit lighter than the AFS-1 models they replaced. So these are being a little bit heavier again. Although, of course, you know, you're talking about a 9.5 pound versus a 9 pound lens.
They're heavy no matter
what. They're darn heavy, and you're going to use a tripod or a monopod with these things. But this makes monopods very, very viable. But what I found very compelling is that they've shaved off a few more feet from that minimum focus distance. Ooh. So that 500 F4, which used to focus at 16 feet, now focuses at 13 feet. Mm-hmm. And you recall I used to have the Sigma 500. It focused to 13 feet. Mm-hmm. And that's very useful if you're shooting wildlife or small things where you do get a little close. Mm-hmm. I think the 600 now goes down to 16 feet instead of 18. Mm-hmm. So anytime they shorten the minimum focus distance, it means you can get a larger reproduction ratio. And to me, that's a great thing.
Yeah, the 200 to 400s that we own have a very short minimum focusing distance.
Yeah, like 2 meters.
Yeah, and you put on a teleconverter, and it's amazing. It's almost like this extremely long macro lens with VR. I've shot dragonflies that way, and works great.
Yeah, that's really useful.
Now, you know, a comment that you'll sometimes read from people is, well, I'm going to put this lens on a tripod. Why do I care about having VR? Isn't that unnecessary? Shouldn't I just go out and buy one of the older lenses and save money? And the older lenses, you know, are going to be a good deal, no doubt, when the VR ones come out.
Well, let's put this in perspective. The price on the 500 VR is going, well, the current price on the 500 F4 is like $7,000. Mm-hmm. That's not cheap.
No.
And these are going to be that same price range.
Yeah. So, you know, people buying the older lenses will get some great deals probably. And if that's your budget range, then, you know, by all means, go ahead and do it. Because they're super lenses and very sharp. But there is value in the VR. And you talked a little bit about the monopod use. And that's one situation where it'll help and it'll stabilize things out, especially at lower shutter speeds. But where it also helps is if you're using a Wimberly mount, like either the full Wimberly, which you'll want to use for something like a 600, or a Sidekick, which will work well for something like the 500 and maybe the 400 too. And in that case, the nice way to use a Wimberly is to leave it unlocked. So you can swing the thing around and pan it and tilt it. You've got an active subject. That makes it very nice. And then just have the VR on. And then when you press the shutter release down, you know, everything stabilizes out even at slower shutter speeds.
Yeah, and that's really useful.
Now, the crazy thing is now you got a D3 with an insane high ISO range on it, or a D300 with very improved high ISO potentially.
Right. I mean, if you're shooting at ISO 1600 most of the time, that's often plenty enough. But
yeah, so we'll see how this works out. It's kind of interesting in some respects. The timing of the VR lenses, those long ones, may not be the best because some of the need is probably a little bit diminished with the new bodies, but it's still a good thing.
Well, and let's talk about that now that we've we've set our table. We've got a D3 and a D300. We've talked about their features. Mm-hmm. How do you see these things playing into, you know, where is Nikon target? You know, who is Nikon targeting?
Besides us?
Besides us. Yeah. Well, and we neglected to mention the price.
Yeah.
Nikon is offering the D3 presumably at about $5,000 US dollars.
Right.
If you're in the United States, I think I think our European friends get kind of hosed on this deal.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Because I think it's the same price in euros.
Yeah, so 5, it's 20% more.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's painful. The D300 is being suggested that they're going to list it for $1,799 or $1,800 US, which is an incredible value. Now, that's without the battery grip and et cetera, but still, you have a real choice now when it comes to these cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, the word on the street is that the Nikon's not done yet.
Yeah. Oh, well, we know that.
We're pretty sure that
there's some cool things showing up in 2008.
Yeah. Like early 2008. You can expect something big,
some more cool things,
some more megapixels, I think.
I believe so.
But anyway, I mean, who are these cameras for? I mean, besides us. So let's start with a D3. You know, where is that going to shine? So we got a 12 megapixel, mm-hmm. 9 frames per second, FX format, so 35 mm-hmm. millimeter format camera. Mm-hmm. Who's going to want that?
Well,
besides everybody.
Besides us, yeah. Here's my take. I mean, I thought about it a little bit even before it came out. So I was thinking, well, you know, is this something I would want? Would it make sense for me? And when I thought through the kind of photography that I typically do, and the one exception would be bird photography, mm-hmm. it matches my needs extraordinarily well. Most of my photography is in the range of, you know, about 17 millimeters up to around 400 millimeters or so, if you're thinking in 35 millimeter terms. That's where most of my shots are made. And the bird photography I enjoy doing, but that's not a big portion of the stuff that I do.
Oh, it's only when I drag you out there.
It's only when you drag me out there, which is a fun thing to do. But, you know, most of it for, you know, larger mammals and things like that, or landscapes, that the other range is great. So in that zone, I've got something that works well in terms of the sensor size and the kind of lenses that I would use with it, you know, which are the ones I currently own. And the low noise at higher ISOs is a nice thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about some tips for getting around higher ISO problems in the past, but as we
Here's a new tip, buy a D3.
Yeah, there you go. Problem gone.
Solved.
Yeah,
solved. Put that one to bed.
Yeah, but that is a nice thing. It, you know, expands the shooting situations that you can be in. And for me, you know, I've got a bunch of lenses gathering dust on my shelf that I don't use as much, except when I get my F6 or my other film bodies out, that I dearly love, honestly. And they're just a little bit awkward with a DX format. And examples of those include the 17-35 2.8, which is a fabulous lens, but a little bit too long for my taste on a DX body. 85mm 1.4, same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit long. My 180 2.8, same thing there. And you could also make a case for the 14-28 that I've got, which I hardly ever use anymore. I use the 12-24 instead. But with the bigger sensor, now I can go, you know, gonzo wide angle again, which is always fun with film.
I look
at something I do all the time.
Yeah.
But when I do it, it's fun.
I look at the D3 as, you know, it offers a couple of advantages. I mean, first of all, it's still a 12 megapixel camera, and anybody who thinks you won't have enough detail, well, it doesn't matter how many pixels you have. It matters how many pixels cover your subject.
Mm-hmm.
So my thought on the D3 is that if your subject fills the frame, whether it's a portrait or a landscape or whatever, or a bird,
mm-hmm.
then you're putting 12 megapixels on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have some really darn good quality pixels
right.
on that image. Where you also, you know, get some bonus from the larger sensor really is like what you've already pointed out, which is ability to use the wide angle lenses that are in your bag and, you know, use mm-hmm. the full image circle on them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a plus. And potentially some... you get a little bit of, you reduce the depth of field, the apparent depth of field a little bit. So,
yeah,
you know,
that's
if you're
not a huge,
but
thing.
Yeah, I think that one's overblown in my opinion.
It is. It's overstated.
You know, but those are the, you know, usually when you ask for a larger sensor, it's to get better high ISO performance, you know, lower noise, depth of field comes up, and then more resolution. Mm-hmm. Now, Nikon, I see with the D3, has really gone after. It's really interesting. Where does this camera fit in with its competition? Well, it's in some ways competing head on with the 1D from Canon.
Right.
But in other ways, it's competing with the 1DS from Canon.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't have as many megapixels as the 1DS, but it's still a full-frame camera.
Mm-hmm.
So photographers who want to get those wides, that's why I saw this camera and I thought with its various crop modes and full-frame and high ISO performance, this is going to be a photojournalist's dream camera.
Yeah, but it's not just a photojournalist
right.
camera.
And a wedding photographer's dream camera. And it's going to be a damn good landscape camera,
oh,
in my opinion.
Oh, man, yeah.
So enter the D300, though.
Right.
In those situations where, now let's go back to Texas,
mm-hmm.
and we're in a blind in Texas, and when you're in a blind, you can't get any closer to your subject unless your subject comes closer to you.
Right.
You're stuck where you are. You have your tripod, and there's a physical barrier between you and the outside world. And if we are both shooting, if I were to shoot a DX body and you were to shoot an FX body,
mm-hmm.
then you'd be throwing away a lot of those pixels unless
right.
you went for either a larger lens or a teleconverter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we both have the 200 to 400 VR, and while we could both still use that same lens, you'd be throwing away a lot more of your image.
Right, and we were both using teleconverters frequently on that lens.
With the D2X.
For the birds, right, with the D2X.
So here's a case where if you crop an image put the D3 into DX mode, the 1.5 crops. Now you're left with 5 megapixels on your image.
Mm-hmm.
So for the same angle of view, to get the same angle of view, your D300 can put more pixels onto your target, given the same focal length and the same distance from your subject. You would have had to have used a 600 millimeter lens to get the same frame coverage at 12 megapixels mm-hmm. had you had a D3 at that mm-hmm. time. So if that is the kind of shooting that you do, then something like a D300 may still be very attractive.
Yeah.
Now, also, look at, what should you get? I mean, everyone's running out to put their pre-orders out, from one of our fine sponsors like Roberts or Berger Brothers or one of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
But think about your lens collection. Now, Rick, I know you've got a huge lens collection
mm-hmm.
because you were collecting lenses when you were still shooting film and, mm-hmm. You were building that up over time. I really didn't start putting in serious dollars into my lens collection until after I had the D2X.
Right.
So that means I've got a 17-55, I've got a Sigma 10-20, and I don't have a 28-70. And if you don't have that lens, you think you might need to invest another $1,500 in a lens to get you back that same range if you move up to a D3.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you can have two D300s for the same price,
yeah.
for less than a price of one D3.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think is very clear is the DX format is quite viable, quite useful, and frankly, just a superb buy.
Well, and I'll add to that. By Nikon putting their flagship autofocus module into the D300, to me that sends a message that says DX is still here.
Yeah.
We are still committed to DX, and the D300 is going to be, for at least the time being, our flagship DX body.
Yeah. And one of the things that you can look at that is it kind of interesting and an indicator of things is if you look at what Canon has done, where they've had several different formats. They actually had three.
They had
the 35 millimeter sized one, the 1.3, and then the 1.6. I mean, most of the sales by far were the 1.6.
Mm-hmm.
So think DX. Wildlife photographers were primarily using the cameras with the 1.3 formats just for the reasons that we were talking about.
But partially because that body was the high frame rate body and also
right.
the high ISO body.
Right. But it was a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then landscape ones tending toward the 35 millimeter
just
size
the sheer
format.
Megapixel.
Mm-hmm. And the use of wider angle lenses
mm-hmm.
too.
So now Nikon's giving you the option where you can be a landscape photographer and, depending on what subjects you shoot, a lot of us shot wildlife with film,
mm-hmm.
but you needed bigger lenses to do it. So if you make your living shooting small critters, I think the DX format is still quite possibly something you should mm-hmm. really consider. And now that we have a D300 with the same autofocus and 6 to 8 frames per second without having to do any, think about it. The only way you could get 8 frames per second with DX body was to buy a D2H at 4 megapixels, mm-hmm. and now you can get 8 frames per second at 12 megapixels. Yeah. So that's really good.
Yeah. Of course, some of what we talked about could change next year.
That's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, we believe the best, or depending on how you look at it, is yet to come.
The most expensive.
The most expensive is yet to come. But this is a very good time to be a Nikon shooter. I think these are two very good options. Both of these cameras are set to be at least initially available sometime in November of this year. We don't know exactly how many will be on. Now, my guess is there'll be more D300s than D3s.
Oh, sure.
Just in terms of production volume.
Yeah. Now, if your budget doesn't support getting one of these, if you're using an older camera, please don't despair. Don't get too worried about it. These are cool cameras, but quite honestly, the features that we were describing aren't going to go out and make a photograph for you. You know, someone with a really good eye and some creativity is going to do a lot better with a D100.
Well, just remember this: no one's using these cameras yet, or at least not, for real, at least not production models. Everyone's still taking really great pictures with what you have.
Yeah.
And with what you have today isn't going to change when these new cameras come out.
No.
It just means that there's other options, and it means that there's going to be better deals to pick up that D200 at a cheaper price that you've been wanting to
and
get.
And it's an outstanding camera.
Right. So that, keep
some perspective on it. It was kind of funny reading stuff on the internet this last week.
Oh, but you know what the best part is that everybody over in that other camp was just absolutely freaking themselves, and they were wetting their pants over these announcements.
Which is, they are nice cameras, but it's silly,
It's totally silly, but
stick to what you're using, whichever brand it is. You're going to
switch brands is usually a bad idea.
It really is.
Unless you don't have a whole lot invested in that brand in terms of lenses and flashes and all that.
But even then, think twice.
But anyway, good day to be.
Yeah. So what are you going to do?
What am I going to do? I haven't decided yet. I can find applications where I could use a D3 80% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were going back down to Texas, I'd probably still bring a D300.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what am I going to do is a lot of it's going to reside on what my wife lets me do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because let's bring reality back into the picture. Not everyone can go and throw down $4,900 or $5,000 on a new body. But I think right now, potentially what interests me is the idea of having, I never bought a backup camera.
Mm-hmm.
To my D2. I never bought that D200 because I was just not quite ready to pull a trigger on it. But I think a situation for me with a D3 and a D300 with a vertical grip would be pretty much a great way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And for a couple of reasons. One is that the pixel dimensions are about the same. So you're not dealing with drastically different images, from either camera. You've got about the same size. The D300, I feel like it's gives me very few compromises compared to a D3, but it's more packable for when I'm on a vacation, I'm on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
And should I want to add another one at that time, I could share a grip between it. But for the times, I just think, what would I bring on the ANPAT next year?
Mm-hmm.
Or if I were going on the ANPAT this year?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a D3 for all the landscape work, and then if I go down to Texas, I'd want a D300,
mm-hmm.
one or more,
mm-hmm.
Because that would be more useful.
Yeah.
Does that mean I can afford to buy that kit? I don't know, because I would still have to, again, I think I don't have quite as much glass as you do.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to look at a D3 as actually being two purchases, that and at least something like a 24-70 or a 28-70 lens to get me something into that mid-range zoom. I do have plenty of lenses on the long end.
Right.
That would be very useful. I just don't think DX lenses on the D3 today make a lot of sense just because of the reduced number of pixels.
Not right now.
Maybe if there was a 22 megapixel version,
maybe,
it would make more sense, but a different camera for a different purpose. So that's what I'm thinking. What about you?
I think the D3 that I'll have this fall will need to have a little friend.
A D300 kind of friend?
Yeah, probably. So.
Yeah, it's so hard when you see these specs. I mean, both of us really love our D2Xs.
Oh, yeah.
But both of us would really like that extra safety net of a higher ISO setting. And I mean that as safety net. It's just, I wouldn't get the shot otherwise, so I'm going to use that higher ISO. I don't think either of us believe that we'd buy a D3 and set it to 6400 and shoot that way.
Yeah.
It's just nice to know that you've got that upper boundary.
But even with those, I'll still go and take my F3 out at times and stuff like that.
But I'm having a hard time convincing myself to sell my D2.
Yeah. Well, it's an awfully good
camera. Because, That's the thing. But I see the D300 as being everything the D2X was and more for less than half the price.
Right.
So in terms of perceived value, I'm perceiving that as a huge value.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, we got that off our chest. That was totally fun. We've been dying to talk about this. So we're going to spend the next couple of minutes, we're going to go real quickly through some little software accessories that we use. Some of these are Photoshop plugins, some of these are standalone applications, but things that maybe some of them we've mentioned before, but we thought we'd rattle off a list of some cool stuff we've been finding.
Yeah, and there are a few new ones in here too.
So right. Let's start with the top of our list, which is something called PT Lens.
Right. It runs on Windows. And
so I've never used it.
I know. Well, you know, sometime you'll get the right kind of computer. But what it does is it corrects distortion for specific lenses and in an image, and it can run either as a standalone or plug-in. And the nice thing about it, it has a database built into it with all that lens information. So when you load an image into it, it works as, you know, like I said, a plug-in or standalone. It automatically corrects for that lens. There's nothing you have to do to fiddle around, and it works quite well.
Yeah, and you can find this, and it's really inexpensive too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not much at all.
So you can get this at www.epaperpress.com/PT Lens.
And we'll put that as well as all the subsequent ones on the show notes. Yeah,
that's right. And the next one is one that I found or I heard about. It's called PT GUI, G-U-I. Mm-hmm. And it's a front-end graphical user interface, as the name may apply if you're a software geek. Mm-hmm. To a program that's, I believe, Unix-based called Panorama Tools. And what this allows you to do is stitch panoramas, and it's really, really powerful. Mm-hmm. It does perspective distortion correction a little bit. It automatically aligns your images. It can handle vertical stitches, horizontal stitches, or combinations of both. You know, so you could have 3x3 or 9x9 block panos, and it's very easy to use, and that's the tool that I used to create the 5-foot-wide panoramic shot that's hanging in my living room. Mm-hmm. And I did it virtually in minutes. Mm-hmm. It was super easy to do, and it's available from ptgui.com. Mm-hmm. And I think it's about $80 or $90.
Okay.
And they have a new version that'll actually do some HDR in addition to your stitching.
You haven't tried that yet.
I have not tried that version. I'm not sure if I paid for the super fancy version or not. Yeah. But if you're looking for HDR, there's a great little program out there called Photomatix Pro.
Right.
Or Photomatix. And it's available at hdrsoft.com.
Yeah. We'll talk more about that program in a future episode where we talk about high dynamic range photos. But this one, like some others, also runs as either standalone or as a Photoshop plugin, and when it's a plugin, you actually use the CS3 or CS2 feature that does the merge and the photos for you.
Boy, it works great.
It does work well. You know, HDR stuff is a little bit tricky, you know.
To get it to look right.
To get it to look right, but this works a whole lot better than the Photoshop tools.
And it offers some different options to doing, you know, if you want to just do some exposure blends and you're just looking to have a highlight and a shadow shot and just combine them, you're not doing true, like, you know, 7-layer HDR merges, it can do some down and dirty stuff that works really well and very quickly.
Yeah.
So I've purchased that one and I like it.
Yeah, we'll talk more about HDR in another show though. The next one is one that I've just used, I think, and it's called 2020 Color MD, and you can get it from phototune.com.
That's T-U-N-E.
And the way this works, it's a bit like going to an optometrist where the program will show you two versions of an image with slightly different color correction or slightly different exposure. Yeah, exactly. One or two. Which do you prefer? And you just click on the one that you prefer, and it goes through, you know, a series of images, and it's very quick. You know, it doesn't take long to do this. And after, you know, picking out which one you like, you know, usually one is warmer, one is cooler, one is brighter, one is darker, it'll fine tune down to an image that when you compare it against the original, it is surprising how much better it is. And it works really well for photos of people is what I found. It's great if you've done slide scans because those are notoriously tricky to get looking quite right in terms of color. But it even works well for digital capture. It's a very nice little tool, and it's surprising. It's such a better approach to getting good color than trying to guess at what might be better and gradually dialing it in.
Now, there used to be a feature in Photoshop, and maybe it's still there, called variations.
This is better.
Which is something like that. But from everything I've seen, this is that done right.
Yeah, this is better.
Really, really handles it well.
And the key, if you try it out and they've got a trial like a lot of programs, is don't spend a whole lot of time staring at the images. Make your decision about which looks better quickly. It's more likely to be the correct one. That way your eyes won't adjust to a different color balance and fool you. But it's a good one. I've been surprised how nice it is.
Now, one sort of software accessory, if you will, that there's a lot of variants on these, as you'll find flying around, is people selling Photoshop actions. So these are Photoshop steps with filters or whatever that are pre-recorded little macros. And you can sometimes buy these. I know that Fred Miranda's website used to sell something called Velvia Vision. Maybe they still do.
I think they do.
To emulate certain. And now you said you found some Photoshop actions out there on the web that are quite useful for portraits and like weddings, that kind of stuff.
Right. They're done by a guy named Gavin Phillips. He's got a site called Photo Effects, just like you would expect, .biz, B-I-Z. And what these are for are portrait photographers, wedding photographers, things like that, and has some really nice, tasteful looks. Includes some pseudo-infrared things, some glamour, a variety of different things, but they're very well done, very tasteful, very nice. And I think if you're doing that kind of work, you absolutely want to take a look at these. In addition to coming with the Photoshop actions, and those are all debugged and worked out for you. And some of them are fairly complex if you're going to try to do them yourself. There's also some nice tutorials that are video and audio together that you can run on your computer.
And that is a huge selling point, because how many times have we picked up some little piece of software and you scratch your head for a week not knowing how to use it, and so then you just stop using it?
Yeah, but Gavin did a very nice job in these, so...
Cool.
Take a peek at them if you're doing that kind of work.
Now, just quickly down the list, there's a few other things which we've talked about before, but we thought we'd mention them because we do still use them and we still like them, and they're useful additions. One is the Alien Skin Exposure from alienskin.com, and this is very, very good at doing black and white conversions and film emulation as a Photoshop plugin. And it does not run by itself. You need to have Photoshop... I think CS or higher to run it, and I believe it was just updated to run in CS3, including the Intel Mac native version of CS3, so that's always a plus for you Mac guys out there with Intel Macs. And we like that one a lot, and we've reviewed that in a previous episode, but we just thought we'd throw that in here because it's still a great product. Another one is one I haven't tried yet, and that's the DxO Film Pack.
Yeah. And it does film emulation as well. It runs either standalone or as a plugin in Photoshop. It also will run within the DxO RAW converter program. And it does a lot of the same, film types, including everyone's favorites, but does a very good job. And, like the others, will also emulate the grain. So that's another one to take a peek at.
And
they did a nice job on that. And incidentally, we haven't, we talked about DxO a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. It seems like ages ago.
Yeah, but they have really improved that program. And if you try the current version of it, it does a very nice job. They really tuned a lot of things that were
cool.
Still a little bit early in the past.
Now, we should point out, I think we've mentioned this before, but with talking about these film emulators, if you're working from RAW, and you're going to apply a film emulator, start with a fairly flat tone curve and not a very saturated image.
Right.
You don't want to start with your normal post-processed image where you've bumped up the tone and the curves and the saturation and the whole deal, because these will tend to overdo it.
Right.
So start with they're expecting a flat, kind of dull, kind of like the ACR default conversion.
That's exactly what they're expecting.
And then you just... one-stop shopping, you click a button and you get the Velvia or the Provia, whatever you get.
Now, with the Alien Skin one, if you use it at its 100% setting, it's going to be strong, and you'll want to dial it back for things like the Velvia emulations down to around maybe 60% or 50% even. But with the DxO one, it's a little bit closer to what you would want just right off the bat.
Okay.
But they both work well.
Very good. And then the last little set I throw out there is the Nik software plugins. The color effects, which we're still waiting to see on Capture NX, come on, Nikon.
Yeah.
You know, get it going here.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be a plug-in for NX very soon. But also the Nix Sharpener, which works in Photoshop.
Yeah.
That's excellent. We've talked about that before.
Right.
And their latest version of their noise removal program, Nix Define 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
And that runs as a Photoshop CS3 plug-in.
Yeah.
And that uses U-Point technology for noise removal. And we talked about that a little bit in
And I'm looking forward to talking about the color effect stuff.
Yeah, it's got some nice little features in there.
We've been using it for a while, and it's really cool.
And we still don't know why they haven't come out with it yet.
But it works great.
We're scratching our head, and we promise it really is going to come out.
Yeah.
People have been emailing us. We keep saying soon, and, well, we don't have any more information on when the actual release will be, but I'm hoping really soon.
But it's a good product.
It is a very good product, and we're looking forward to... I'm personally looking forward to seeing, hopefully, that Nix develops all of their plugins for NX, because that would be a wonderful thing for those of us who use that program.
Mm-hmm.
But...
Yeah,
it'd
be very cool to have the Define and
the sharpener especially. Oh, that would be so great.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm getting carried away with dreaming again. I see that we've hit the 55 and a half minute mark, so our listeners are probably starting to drive off the road at this point.
Yeah.
And so we wish everyone in the United States a happy Labor Day weekend. Enjoy the 3-day holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And for the rest of you out there, we will see you in a couple of weeks. Don't forget to drop us an email at talkradio@nikonians.org.
Yeah, and as always, please do vote for us out on podcastalley.com, and you can find the web link to that on our show notes page also.
Absolutely.
We do appreciate it.
Okay, we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.